All right, we're going to back in our study of Ecclesiastes this morning. So we're in the last chapter. How about that? You thought we would never be there. You know, there's something about a perfect ending. It's like when a book, you read a book and like you love it. It's just a great book. And then you get to the very end and it's just like perfect. Like somebody writes something the way it concludes, or a film or a play or something like that. I love it when that happens. You just feel really good, like, yes, oh, yes, perfect ending. You know, I was thinking of A Tale of Two Cities, which is one of my favorite novels, and it's, you know the story. I don't know if you know the story, but a man is exchanging himself for somebody that's going to the guillotine during the Reign of Terror in Paris, and he's going to sneak into the prison. He works his way into the prison. He trades places with him, so he's going to die for him. That's the sort of the theme. And he kind of wasted his life, and he loves this woman, and he's saving her husband so he can go be with the family. But anyway, in the book, he's working his plan to get this whole thing to work out for him, and this thing from the Bible comes into his head while he's walking the streets of Paris, and he's thinking all that night before he's going to do this act. And he's thinking about, it says, from childhood he remembered these words, I am the resurrection and the life, he that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And that's kind of going through his mind. And in the book, so he does the act, and then the last line of the book, which is the perfect ending, it's very famous, it's a far, far better thing I do than I have ever done, it's a far greater rest I go to than I have ever known. You know, that's... And so in 1935, they made this really epic version of Tale of Two Cities, and that's how it ends. He says the words. He's about to have his head chopped off, but it's 1930, so they don't show it. So the camera kind of goes up, and it kind of floats in the clouds, and then those words come out. And then there's like a screen credit, and it says, I am the resurrection and the life. And it's like perfect. It's just a perfect ending. So anyway, my whole point is, Ecclesiastes has a perfect ending, okay? So with all the ways that Solomon has taken us down this path of wisdom, looking at the emptiness of the world and the uncertainty and all the under-the-sun thinking and all the contradictions of this world, he ends up on something as absolutely as solid as steel. I mean, it's just the perfect end of the book. So, you know, Solomon is one of those sort of Socrates-like, super annoying people that won't let a matter go until he's worked it out to the very end, all the way through. And he's been like that all the way here. He's walked us through the vanity of man-made philosophy, the emptiness of it. It's a no-holds-barred, no-easy-answers search for truth. We've gone all through that all these last months here. But before we got here to the end, we had to know a few things. First, the weakness of philosophy, of human philosophy, man-made philosophy. Philosophy that excludes, that leaves out divine revelation, that leaves God out of the picture, that's built only on what we can see or measure or touch, that kind of a thing. Without revelation, philosophy ends up in a vain, fruitless search for meaning. There is no meaning outside of God. And so he builds his case for that. We've gone through all of that over the weeks. But ancient philosophers were looking for the good life, the formula for the good life. They wanted truths that you could follow and live a long, healthy, prosperous life. Except, no matter what rules or advice they might come up with, these ancient wise men, it never works for everyone. It doesn't work for everyone. Formulas are always frustrated in this fallen world by uncertainty and unpredictability. Things are going to happen that'll get in the way of the best plan you have, the wisest plan you have, the best life you try to live. So in the real world, chance often governs destiny as more than wisdom does very often. So there's just too many exceptions to the benefits of following wisdom, and that's what Solomon's been trying to explain. And he's all for wisdom. He loves wisdom. He's the wisest man of his age, but he knows the limitations of it. So in chapter 9, verse 1, he said, I saw again under the sun that the race is not to the swift, and the battle is not to the warriors, neither is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favor to men of ability, for time and chance overtake them all. And that's true of life. So rules and maxims and wise ideas are percentages at best, and you don't always succeed with them. So That's why honesty and virtue are rare. They're more unusual than they are common. You don't always succeed with them, and people want to succeed, so they'll cast those aside to succeed with their plan for their life. And we all know that well-placed lies can achieve a lot of things in this world, right? People get contracts, jobs, money, sexual gratification, sympathy, you name it. People lie and cheat all the time, and they actually succeed with that sometimes. So some go to jail, and some become billionaires. You never know, right? So some take over whole countries, and that kind of thing happens on a regular basis. So there doesn't appear to be a clear-cut pattern that works all the time to get ahead with integrity. It doesn't seem to work that way in the real world. That's why so many people cast aside integrity to move forward in life. So a true philosophy, a real answer, should be universal. It should be true of all men everywhere. That's how it should work. It's supposed to work that way. And our natures are the same, so the good life should be open to all. We're all human. We all have the same basic nature. So the truth should be the same for all. But no philosophical system that comes from human thinking, just under the sun thinking, as we've talked about, just this world is all there is, kind of an idea, no philosophical system has found the truth that satisfies in all circumstances or every human heart. There isn't something that applies to every person. So why is that? Why are answers so elusive? Why is that? The main problem is its man-made philosophy is so limited. It's extremely limited in what it can even consider or think about. It guarantees failure. Let me use an analogy from medical science. You know, and just think about hundreds of years ago, medical guys are trying to figure out things. You know, they're carving up bodies and doing all the stuff they do and trying to find answers. But until certain discoveries come along, medicine can only go so far, right? If you can't see everything or grasp everything, it only gets to a certain point. And pretty much it's by trial and error. So if you think of the best scientific medical mind, a genius, without a microscope, before there was a microscope, he's just not going to know so many key things about the human body and the human system. Even with a microscope, it took a long time to understand that those little tiny creatures they can see in your blood, you know, microorganisms and bacteria and viruses and parasites and all that stuff, they had no idea what those things were or what they did. It took a long time to figure that out. So even when they could see it, it took many, many decades, hundreds of years actually, to figure out what those things actually were. So some things are just discovered by accident, even in the medical world. I'll give you a great Civil War example. You know I love Civil War examples. So they used to sew up wounds with silk thread. That's what they did. Now in the South, they didn't have nearly as many resources as the North, so they ran out of silk. And there was a blockade. They couldn't bring silk from England, all that stuff. So they kind of ran out of suture material. So they decided to try horsehair. But horsehair was really stiff, like from a mane or a tail or something. It was really stiff, so they boiled it. And they boiled it. It was softer, so it worked better. And guess what? The infection rate in wounds went way down. They had no idea why. It just worked. And that was before they started boiling instruments and all that kind of stuff, right? That's before they learned that. So it's just one of those things. It's like trial and error. Oh, well, that works. So accidental discoveries, right? If you boil things, there'll be less infections. Well, the same is true of spiritual questions, the big questions about life, purpose, meaning, why are we here, what do we exist for? That can only be known if you know the creator of mankind. Those things can only be known by him because there's so many things that are hidden from us. If we don't hear from God, we can only guess at the answers to the big questions. And by big questions, I mean meaning, you know, why we're here, all of those kind of things that people ask when they start to enter the world, you know, well, what's it all about? You know, who are we? Where do we go somewhere after we die? What are the answers to those big questions? Modern man, because of his limited thinking, says we're just biology. So that's the dominant view of the educational establishment. We are only biology because that's all we can measure. So that's what human beings are. There's no purpose except furthering your biology, right? We are accidents of evolution. We don't know why we care about things like truth and justice or love to create art and music and appreciate all those kind of things. None of the other animals do that or contemplate these big questions or ideas, but humans are kind of unique, but we can't really explain it. It's just an accident of biology and interaction with other creatures, right? So in science, it's got to be repeatable and verifiable to be true. You've got to be able to put it in some kind of measuring system or test tube or something and repeat that. And then it's true. If it's not true, it's not there. So all the unique, wonderful, amazing qualities of human beings has to be an accident. That's what science concluded, because science can only accept what is measured. So if there's a miracle that happens, let's say the Son of God enters the world, some kind of miracle, they can't acknowledge it, because it's got to be a measurable thing. So even if a huge miracle happened and you were there, if you can't test it or repeat it, it doesn't count. So they just dismiss all of those kind of things. And I totally get why. Philosophically, they're making that dismissal, not based on evidence or observation so much. So the spiritual realm can be acknowledged only if you can be measured. That's the idea. Even though, if you just look at human beings, our consciousness is actually a witness that we have an immaterial part of ourselves. That's the spirit that indwells us, right? We are spiritual beings as well as physical beings. And we know that because that's what's doing the thinking. That you're sitting there listening to what I'm saying, and that's the part of you that's understanding what I'm saying. It's your spiritual self. It's that part of you. So, but human consciousness, you can't measure it. You can measure the brain waves and activity and the biology of it, but you can't measure the spirit. So it doesn't exist. That's modern philosophy. There's no measurable test. That means we can't really know unless we hear from God. We can't know spiritual things by observation. So all of this book of Ecclesiastes has been showing how inadequate observation is. It's valuable. You can learn a lot of wise things. That's what Solomon's been saying. But it doesn't answer the big questions at all, right? Because you can't put a soul or a spirit in a test tube. God has to tell us that we are persons that are made in his image. If he doesn't tell us that, we don't know that. So it has to be communicated from outside of us. God is not material. And he's not only there, but our very existence in every way absolutely completely depends on him. If he wasn't there, we wouldn't even exist. Now, remember in chapter 3, Solomon said God designed the world like it is, with all of its uncertainty and difficulty and trials and problems and weakness and failure, so that we would be unsatisfied. And if we're unsatisfied, we'll start to look for him. That was why God made the world. That's why everything is the way it is. That's why he laid a curse upon the earth, so that everything doesn't quite work out. So we'll look for him. So here we are. We have all these unique, wonderful qualities as human beings. We're looking for meaning, for life to continue. And we have all these unique capacities, love, morality, aesthetics, spirituality. And we can't make sense of it without help from outside of us. That means seeking God's explanation for these things, humbly seeking that and accepting what he says. So Ecclesiastes chapter 12 is beautifully structured to offer us that truth that is beyond our capacity to know unless God speaks to us. So God is speaking in his word here. That's what we're looking at. So God created everything. He created the heavens. He created the world, the distant galaxies, the stars, the genetic code, this incredible diversity of life, the amazing balance of the world we inhabit. He is a God of limitless power and creativity, and we can see it in creation all around us. It's there. And he is infinite, an infinitely powerful being. He's outside of time even. He can dwell in all times at the same time. The future is as real to him as the present is real and the past is real. He knows life and death. He knows what lies beyond this life for us. He is infinitely moral as well. God is just and good, and he cares about what we do and even what we think. So Ecclesiastes 12 spans kind of all of these ideas and ties them together just to the few years that we are ordained to live in this world. We're only here for a short time. And this is going to bring it all together here. So he also ties the beginning and the end of human life from youth to age. I can look over here and go youth to, well, I won't say anything. Just point at myself, youth and age, okay? Almost got in trouble there. It's the anesthetic. It's still affecting me. I'm going to blame that. So there is a universal principle, a truth that applies to all people in every age. That's what Solomon's going to tell us. And it's a truth that could not be grasped by human thought alone or observation alone. It can only come from God who created us, and it will judge us. So in chapter 11, we looked at Solomon's advice to young people. And he thought that one's youth should be enjoyed, lived. You're only young once, so have experiences and adventures as your heart desires. That's not a blanket open end to just party, because there's a limit on it. And if you remember chapter 11, verse 9, he says, "Rejoice, young man, during your childhood, and let your heart be pleasant during the days of young manhood. And follow the impulses of your heart and the desire of your eyes. Yet, know that God will bring you to judgment for all these things." So God's watching everything we do and all of our motives and all of our actions and how we conduct ourselves here in this world. That's a theme he's going to pick up again here in chapter 12, because he starts much more simply than that. He really only has one word for young people in chapter 12, which begins chapter 12. So most of the chapter is about being old. But having observed life from beginning to end, it's with wisdom that he starts with this word: remember. Remember. So that's the first word of chapter 12. Remember what? Verse 1. Remember God. Remember God. Remember your Creator. So now the word remember is a word which in ancient Hebrew writing, it can mean what we mean by remember, just calling to mind, but it's got a much deeper meaning as well. And I want to try to show you that real quick here. So for us, when we say remember, we mainly mean recalling something to mind. I remember you, you know, that kind of a thing. That sort of idea, if you talk about remember God in that sense, then remembering God wouldn't be much more than don't forget your lunch, remember, you know, that kind of an idea. Or, did you put your jacket on? Remember, it's cold outside. That sort of remembering, that idea. Don't forget God, he's the ruler of the universe. Remember, it's not that. It's not that kind of remember. So I'm going to show you a couple of examples from the Old Testament real quick. So Genesis devotes a lot of space to Noah's flood. It's over many chapters, right? The great flood. It uses a lot of space there for good reason. It's an incredible demonstration in history of God's power and his wrath against human sin. It was a catastrophic event on a global scale, huge event, changed the world forever. And after the flood reached its height, Genesis 8:1 says, right in the middle, I won't get into the technical part of it, but actually, I'm going to give you a little secret. The entire story of the Genesis flood is what they call a chiasm. It's a gigantic structure where it starts in one place and it follows these lines all the way down to one sentence, and then that sentence backs up and you can compare the line. It makes a kind of a thing like this. So it comes down to this point, to this key sentence, and then it backs away and it's almost exact parallels going back out again. The whole chapters are like that. The whole several chapters do that. It's called a chiasm. But what's that one sentence that it all boils down to? It all comes down to and moves away from this sentence: and God remembered Noah. God remembered Noah. What does that mean? It doesn't mean, oh yeah, I had that guy on the boat and I had all the animals in the world go there and yeah, I set that all up. I remember Noah. It doesn't mean that. Did God forget Noah? No. So the text actually says, but God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark, and God caused a wind to pass over the earth, and the water subsided. So God, that's the key idea. God remembered, then God caused, okay? So remembering here has this idea of involvement. I'm directing my energy to do something. That's what remember means many times in the Old Testament. Another really good example, just a simple example, would be Rachel. Genesis 30:22. God remembered Rachel and opened her womb. It wasn't like, oh, I forgot all about Rachel. No, that wasn't it. I just remembered Rachel. He's giving attention to something to cause something to happen. Usually a good thing, a favor, a blessing like that. So remembering is often much more than just bringing to mind. It often means giving attention with the intention to favor or bless someone. So to do some act on somebody's behalf. That's what it means to remember. Here's Dan read earlier in the service, Deuteronomy chapter 8. Let me go back to that and read part of that again. Deuteronomy 8:11. Beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and his ordinances and his statutes, which I am commanding you today. Otherwise, when you have eaten and are satisfied and have built good houses and lived in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply and your silver and gold multiply and all that you have multiplies, then your heart will become proud and you will forget the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Then he goes through that whole explanation about how he fed a manna in the wilderness, and it says, in the wilderness he fed you manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and that he might test you to do good for you in the end. See, he's doing it for their good. Otherwise, you may say in your heart, my power and my strength of my hand made me this wealth. But you shall remember the Lord your God. Not just, oh, there's a God. Oh, yeah, I forgot about God bringing us through the whole thing. I just remembered. It doesn't mean that. It means God created all of this for us. He provided all of this for us. I am going to do for him. I'm moving in his direction. I am focusing on him. I'm paying attention to him. I'm giving him my energy, my strength, my concentration. He's everything, and I'm going to give that to him. That's the idea. Remembering God isn't just the acknowledgement of his existence. It's giving attention to who he actually is. So he says, remember his commandments. He's a God who gives moral instruction. Specific things to do. That's the duty that we owe him. So remembering is, God, I need to obey you. I need to honor you. I need to reverence you. I need to give you all the glory and credit you deserve. So Solomon uses remember in that way, this fuller, more ancient way. Remembering to action is the idea. So chapter 12, verse 1, first he calls our attention to God as the creator. Solomon encompasses the whole of a man's life from youth to old age here. So he starts with the young person. Chapter 12, verse 1. Remember also your creator in the days of your youth. Don't wait till you're old. Don't wait till your energy is gone. Use your energetic years, not for futility, but remember God when you're young. Start right now. Enjoy your youth. And give your attention to your creator, because you exist for him. That's your purpose. That's why you're in this world. He's the foundation of all meaning and all purpose in this life. So do it, he says, before. Remember God before. Remember your creator in the days of your youth. So, before what? Here he chooses to spend time just kind of reflecting on old age. This is a really interesting passage, and it's so relevant to my life. He calls that period the evil days. And he says, those are the days you say I have no delight in them. So what he's saying is serve and love God now in the days of activity when life can be engaged with his blessing, because the days will come when many aspects of life are more endured than enjoyed. I guess is the way to say it, right? So he uses a lot of poetry here describing extreme old age and the infirmities that come with it. So I'm going to remind you of your life. So hold on. Verse 2. Before, so remember God, the creator of your youth, before the sun and the light, the moon and the stars are darkened and clouds return after the rain. What's he describing there? Things are kind of closing in. You know, the world's getting... Our experience of the world is darkening. We've got less going on. So one commentator said it this way, Derek Kidner. He's got a great commentary on Ecclesiastes. I think it's beautiful. So let me read this for you. He says, there is a chill of winter in the air of verse 2. As the rains persist and the clouds turn daylight into gloom and then night into pitch blackness, it is a scene somber enough to bring home to us not only fading physical and mental powers, but the more general desolation of old age. There are many lights that are liable to be withdrawn, besides those of the senses and the faculties, as one by one old friends are taken, familiar customs change, and long-held hopes have to be abandoned. All this will come at a stage when there is no longer the resilience of youth or the prospect of recovery to offset it. In one's early years, and for the greater part of life, troubles and illnesses are chiefly setbacks, not disasters. One expects the sky to clear eventually. It is hard to adjust to the closing of that long chapter, to know that now, in the final stretch, there will be no improvement. The clouds will always gather again, and time will no longer heal, but kill. So verse 2 offers that more general sense of decline over time. And Solomon uses a different word picture in verses 3 and 4 to describe the effects of age. This is kind of amusing, and it's easy to relate to. So he calls it, he uses the imagery, this is poetry, he's using imagery of a great house, okay? A great manor, a state, that kind of a thing. So verse 3, in the day that watchmen of the house tremble and mighty men stoop, the grinding ones stand idle because they are few, and those who look through the windows grow dim. And the doors on the street are shut, and the sound of the grinding mill is low. And one will arise at the sound of the bird, and all the daughters of song will sing softly. He's talking about us falling apart. That's it. This is all poetic imagery of us falling apart. Thank God, the daughters of song, we have hearing aids now where we can pick up their sounds again, right? But the watchmen tremble, so things cause fear that when we were younger, we never even had to think about. I'd better be careful where I'm walking and where that step is and all of those kind of things, right? Mighty men stoop, he says. Their vigor is gone. We still call teeth grinders, maybe because of this text, but he's talking about that too, the grinders. And in the house, the grinders would be, in a real house, the grinders would be the servants who make bread and all that. But they're few as the house declines. So, yeah, it's actually referring to the loss of teeth in verse 3. See, we can get new teeth, too, sometimes. But they didn't do that much in the old days. So in verse 4, the doors of the street are shut. That's when the teeth are gone and the mouth sort of folds in on itself, you know. And then verse 4 seems also a reference to early waking, when the sounds of the birds in the morning are dimmed by deafness. And then verse 5 is even more direct, and other illustrations from nature start to come in. Verse 5, furthermore, men are afraid of a high place and of terrors on the road. Old age just makes you more fearful of falling. You know, it's a big deal if you fall down, so you can actually get broken. When you're young, you just bounce back. So that's exactly why you teach your kids not to run around when there's elderly people around. That's true, right? Why do you tell them that? Because that makes them afraid. This little kid's going to crash into me while he's running all around being crazy, right? So they're worried about that. So you teach your children, don't run around with elderly people there, right? Because falls are bad and bones are brittle. You don't worry. You can tell them to run around 40-year-olds, but you can't tell them to run around 75-year-olds. It's different. Don't do that, right? And then the almond tree blossoms. The almond tree blossoms. White hair. The grasshopper drags himself along, he says. Grasshoppers are made to leap and fly, but now they're moving a lot slower, and they're dragging their tails. And the caperberry is ineffective. We won't get into that too much, but caperberries were like mandrake roots or rhinoceros horns in the old world, or Viagra today, that kind of an idea. That part of life just kind of fades out, you know, it diminishes. Then verse 5, for man goes to his eternal home while mourners go about in the street. So finally, after all of that process, we are gone, right? We leave this world. Death comes for everyone. Then verse 6 harkens back to verse 1 and uses the word remember again. Verse 1 called upon us to remember the Creator. But now it's remember God before we succumb to death. And again, he uses this poetic imagery, verse 6. Remember him, God, before the silver cord is broken and the golden bowl is crushed and the pitcher by the well is shattered and the wheel at the cistern is crushed. So he's using that same kind of imagery there. The silver cord is holding the golden bowl and it breaks and then the bowl is crushed and its contents are lost forever. And that's when we lose our life. That's this vessel is broken and our spirit leaves our bodies. Those delicate items, our bodies are delicate, and they get more and more delicate and fragile over time. So it kind of ends to be a shell at the end, and that's exactly what it's describing here. That's why it says to remember God. Verse 7, then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. That's how the book began. And now it's coming to the end. He's making a full circle here. So this life ends, and the vanity, the emptiness that made up all those years, who do not remember God in their youth, they'll be empty in the latter years as well. The end will be empty. So he's speaking to the living. He's not speaking to the dead. He's speaking to the living. Remember your Creator. Remember him before vanity overtakes your life to a sad end. So live for him, serve him, walk with him. Each step of your life, know God and walk with him. Know him, because all of that's coming down the line. And then Solomon, this part, that's kind of his conclusion there of what he's trying to say about all that. And then he kind of steps out and starts talking to us directly about wisdom. It's sort of like, ever been in a play when the actor comes out at the end and talks about the play? Or if you go to a book reading, like in a library or something, and the author's there, and he talks about his book, he gives you a lecture about his book. That's kind of what happens in verse 9 through 12. So he starts talking about why he's written all of this, why we've gone through these 12 chapters. In addition to being a wise man, the preacher, that's what he called himself in chapter 1, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, and he pondered, searched out, and arranged many proverbs. The preacher sought to find delightful words and to write words of truth correctly. Verse 11. The words of wise men are like goads, and masters of these collections are like well-driven nails. They are given by one shepherd. But beyond this, my son, be warned. The writing of many books is endless, and excessive devotion to books is wearying to the body. By the way, verse 12 is a seminary student's favorite verse. That's their theme verse for their life. The writing of many books is endless, and excessive devotion to books is wearying to the body. If you did that, you know. So what's he saying? Solomon's saying that wisdom is simpler than it appears. You don't need encyclopedia-sized works to figure out wisdom. He's also telling us that he has not taken any shortcuts himself. That's why this book is 12 chapters long. He's walked the whole path himself. He's told his own story, starting from the beginning of the book. That's what he's been doing. He's telling his own story. He pondered. He searched out. He arranged these proverbs. He taught wisdom. But wisdom really comes from God. That's what he's saying in verse 11. The words of wise men are like goads, and masters of these collections are like well-driven nails. They are given by one shepherd. Who's the shepherd? Well, God is the shepherd. God is the shepherd. You know, it's his dad that wrote the 23rd Psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd." Solomon's dad wrote that. That's what he's got in mind right there. There's one shepherd. That's a wonderful, intimate term for God. He's a shepherd. What does a shepherd do? He cares for his flock. He looks out for the flock. He provides for them. So it's not just your creator now, but it's your shepherd, the one who cares for you. And truth, as truly wise men will share it, truth works like a goad. You know what a goad is? It's like a staff or a stick or maybe a pointy stick, and the shepherds would go along and use that to get the sheep to go where he wants them to go. Where do you think the one shepherd wants us to go? To him, right? He wants us to be with him, to live with him, to walk with him. So he goads us with all of this wisdom that we've been reading through Ecclesiastes. The wise man's words are goads to get us to go in a certain place, a certain direction, to move towards God, not away from God. Goads are meant to direct you to the place the shepherd wants you to go. It may be unpleasant to be goaded. Ow! That goad hurt. Oh, he stuck me with a stick. That's what the sheep are thinking, right? But I'm going to go where he wants. But it takes you to the right place. When the shepherd goads you, he's taking you to the right place, the place where where joy is, where the water is, where the feed is, you know, all of those kind of things, where it's safe. So Solomon takes us in all these unpleasant directions. He's been goading us all through the book, talking about vanity and emptiness and uncertainty and all those kind of things. And he's asked us to look squarely with him at the vanity of life, the emptiness of the human condition, its incoherence, its frustrations, all to find this formula for the good life, which is elusive. And while some things are better than others, he says no formula works for everyone. That's what we've seen all through the book, except one thing. And the one thing is the one shepherd, the creator of the universe, the living God, the God of all the earth. And then here's the secret, verse 13. The conclusion, couldn't wait to get there, could you? The conclusion, when all has been heard, is fear God and keep his commandments, because this applies to every person. Verse 14, for God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. So fear God. And Solomon has said this several times in the book. Now it is working as a goad. Now it's the well-driven nail. Now it's the key principle of everything. He said fear God, but now it's everything here. This is the final truth. This is the end. This is the conclusion. Fear God and keep his commandments. Why should I do that? Because this applies to every person. See, all the other stuff, all the human wisdom, all the under the sun thinking, all the philosophy, it doesn't apply to every person because things go wrong all the time. But this applies to every person because every person comes to death and we all end up in this place where our spirit goes back to God. After death, what happens? He says judgment. Judgment. Solomon absolutely believes that the soul lives beyond death. The death of our bodies. What did he say in verse 7? At death, the spirit of man returns to God. That's what he says. So we're all going to face the Lord. And there are no secrets with God because he knows everything. There's no secrets. Jesus said, nothing is hidden that will not become evident, nor anything secret that will not be known and come to light. That's in Luke chapter 8, verse 17. So that's it right here. This whole study following Solomon's argument is meant to lead us to this very place. Fear God and keep his commandments, because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. There's a word you could use to describe this judgment. Inescapable. That would be the word. We'll all end up there. Are you ready? Are you prepared for that day? Every creature made in God's image, every human being that God created with this capacity for morality, for this innate sense of right and wrong, will face God in judgment. We will give an account. Fear God and keep his commandments is the baseline for judgment. That's what we'll be judged by. That will be what is evaluated. Did we fear God and keep his commandments? Now, there's a lot to say about this. Judgment will be very different for the person who trusts in Christ than it will be for the person that rejects him. There'll be very different experiences. Just as the Bible separates all of humanity into two groups over and over again, Jesus did that constantly, there are two very different kinds of judgment. So we're going to camp there a little bit next week, next Sunday, Lord willing, and explore more in depth what it means to fear God, since that's what we're commanded to do, and then how these judgments differ. So come back next time, and we shall explore those themes together, okay? Let's pray. Oh, Lord, you had Solomon take us a long way around to this final conclusion, to fear you and to keep your commandments. That's the message. Don't let us forget it, our great Father. Goad us. Help us understand it. Not as a theological idea, but as something central to our lives and this planet and this world. And may you receive from us the love and the reverence that belongs to you. We ask in the name of our great Savior, Jesus. Amen.